Part 6. Child of Hallows. Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. The soul that rises with us, our life's star, hath had elsewhere its setting, and cometh from afar, not in entire forgetfulness, and not in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come. William Wordsworth, Ode on Intimations of Immortality Recollected from Early Childhood. 17. Connor had waited on the steps for Pauly to leave school. Usually they would be carpooled home by Mom or Maggie, but that had obviously ended. The thing was that Pauly, leader of the Connor Busters though he was, remained the only real friend he'd ever had. He had to reach him somehow, and he thought that the way to do it was still through the idea of the aliens, despite what had happened. If they were real, then maybe he could contact them somehow and get them to come back, with Pauly as a witness. It was an audacious, insane idea, but there were more than a few websites out there put up by folks who were doing just that and posting video of the UFOs that had turned up. He'd communicated with one or two of them and gotten detailed instructions about how to do it, using, as one of them had put it, a flashlight, patience, and a serious interest in meeting them. All day at school he had kept to himself. There was nothing else he could do, not without triggering some sort of additional humiliation. As it was, everybody had gotten up from the table and moved when he sat down for lunch. He had eaten alone, ostentatiously and purposely reading a book none of them could begin to understand. Physics from Fisher Information. A rather basic text, actually. He had considered going the total eccentric route, perhaps refusing to speak anything except Latin and dyeing his hair purple or something. But that would just justify his isolation, and he did not really want to be isolated. Faint though it might be, there remained the possibility that some girl might someday do just slightly more than run screaming when he drew near. Amy, for example. After all, they had an embarrassing past in the woods, did they not? It had, when he was 10 and she was 11, involved the revelation of body parts back where the little stream flowed and the bluebells nodded along its banks. He'd been thinking fairly carefully this past couple of days about what actually had happened the other night. What did the Kelton's video really show? The answer to that question, he thought, might be far less obvious than it seemed. It was possible that the legendary greys of internet fame actually were involved, but only very remotely. Although the search for extraterrestrial intelligence people claimed that the chances of finding a signal from another world was vanishingly small, that was incorrect. They were actually pretty good. About 0.4% a year. He thought that if somebody actually had appeared here from another planet, they must be desperate. It would take vast resources to cross interstellar space, and huge amounts of time. Wormholes and such were science fiction. The reason was simple. It was theoretically possible to bend space until two distant points touched, but the amount of energy necessary was unimaginable. To bend the United States until, say, Phoenix and Buffalo touched, would be child's play by comparison. Faster than light transmission of signals was indirectly possible using quantum entangled particles, but the movement of structured physical objects at hyperspeeds was out of the question. So, if they were here, they had come at less than light speed, probably far less, and thus even a journey from Centauri A, the closest sun-like star, would have taken many years. Internet scuttlebutt had the greys coming from Zeta Reticuli, a double star. Such a situation would make for planets with lots of seasons and some really eccentric orbits, but it wasn't completely impossible. All of these thoughts danced in his mind, even while at another level, he considered his father's straightforward advice to confront the kids who were tormenting him. Dad was no genius, but his advice could be relied on, and Connor intended to take it. "Pauly," he said as he came down the steps. "Hey."
"Hey, Connor.
Would you like to come over?" Pauly stopped. He stared at him like he was some kind of bizarre animal. He was flanked by two of his most unpleasant new friends, Kevin Sears and Will Heckle. course not, he said. The video's real, Polly. We all ought to respect what it means. The event happened.
I wasn't there, Connor. I didn't see it.
Connor was pleased to hear the anger and disappointment in his voice. This was precisely what he had expected. He had taken Polly exactly where he wanted him to go, and now he would win him back.
You know I can fix things, he said.
Maybe I can fix that.
How? Build a time machine?
What if I could get them to come back?
Will Heckle burst out laughing. A smiling Kevin shook his head.
No, wait, Polly said. I want to hear this.
I can call them, Connor said.
With you as a witness.
The boys were not laughing now.
If I do it,
then will you agree to cancel the Connor Busters?
Well, sure.
Sure, Connor.
Come over after supper and spend the night.
You'll meet the Grays.
What about us? Can we meet the Grays too, little boy?
Not yet, Kev.
Kevin grabbed his jacket, loomed over him.
Kevin to you.
Connor stared right back.
Okay, Kev. I'll make a note of that.
Finally, Kevin released him. Connor turned and went down the steps, looking for Mom's car in the line out front. On the way home, he wondered what the odds were of Polly showing up. Actually, he thought they were excellent. In fact, he would show. But the larger question was, how in the world would he get the Grays to come to the party? He also knew that he would get resistance from Mom, so he said nothing in the car. In fact, he waited until after dinner, until just before Polly would appear. Incidentally, Polly's going to sleep over tonight. She stopped clearing the kitchen table of dishes.
No, he isn't.
Yes, he is, Mom. He's been invited, and he is.
No way, Jose.
This did not surprise him, but he pretended that it did.
Mom, come on.
Connor, no, you're groveling.
Mom, I have arranged a sleepover, simple as that.
I don't want any Warners in this house, not Polly, not Amy, not the parents, especially not Maggie and Harley. You find other friends.
Then let's move into town. I'm 12 miles from the nearest other kids my age.
You're so handsome when you're mad, she said.
God, the condescension.
All right, let's come to a compromise. I invited Polly. He didn't say yes or no. If he comes, he comes.
Why did you invite him?
Because, Mother, if you diagram the social configuration of my class, you quickly discover that Polly Warner is at the center of every major structural orbit, and, in fact, I am not going to make any headway with anybody until I have solved my relationship with him. She almost burst into tears. To hear him applying his genius to a problem as trivial as being accepted by some little bully with a room temperature IQ. She went to him and hugged him. He came to her with rag-like looseness, neither willing nor unwilling.
You know something that's going to happen in a couple of years, Connor. In a couple of years, Polly, who looks like a little dump truck, is going to be running after girls and getting nowhere. They're going to be all over you. You're sweet, you're smart, and you look like a movie star.
That's then, and this is now.
What about my compromise? Fair?
He'd won, of course. She couldn't very well call the Warners and tell Polly not to come, only to find that he hadn't been planning to anyway.
Since last night, Connor had been using the same technique of meditation the internet contact mavens used, and intended to make the same flashlight signals toward the sky that they did, and at the same time, 3:33 in the morning. One of them had craft showing up about 70% of the time. The other had never had a failure in 2 years, and had hundreds of hours of video, including a photo of the palm of a long, thin-fingered hand with claws pressed against a window. Connor had gotten the guy to upload a high-res file of this photo to his personal FTP site, where he usually collected dissertations and things, and had analyzed it carefully. Using a very conservative extrapolation algorithm, he'd been able to bring out the fingerprints. They were absolutely remarkable in one respect. They had completely symmetrical whorls. He'd thought at once, if a machine had fingers, they'd look like this.
The design wasn't a digital trick. It was actually on the hand. And it was self-consistent, too. He'd measured it micrometer by micrometer. It was a real print, all right. Maybe the Keltons had gotten the first somewhat clear shot of a gray. This guy had definitely gotten the first fingerprint. Mom and Dad were having all kinds of hush-hush conversations about the grays and about their friend Marcy Cotton, who Connor had understood from their transparently cryptic comments to one another, had been the person screaming in the craft the other night. No matter how well they hid it, even from themselves, Connor could see that the incident had terrified his parents. Therefore, he certainly had no intention of telling them that he planned to attempt to vector the grays in. "Just one thing," his mom said, and he instantly anticipated one of her little zingers. "I want you guys to sleep upstairs. We don't want you sleeping alone in the basement anymore." "I don't care for those beds," Connor said smoothly, hoping to deflect this zinger. "Also, we're going to be doing gaming until late." "Not downstairs, you aren't." There was a crash, and Pauly came banging through the back door. "It's snowing," he yelled. "We're going to be sledding in the morning, plus Gestapo Torture Fest came from Games Unlimited." He brushed past Caitlin and went pounding downstairs, Connor hurrying along behind him. She went into the living room, where Dan had been watching the Kelton boys' video again and again. As she walked in, he froze the blurry image of the hydrocephalic with fly eyes on the screen. "I don't want the boys sleeping in the basement," she said.
"God, no."
"And turn that damn thing off. It's hideous." When she sat down, he got up from the far end of the couch and moved closer to her. Before she realized it, she'd re-established distance between them. He did not try again. Instead, he gestured toward the TV. "I've had them with me all my life. I've never had a seizure. It's been memory, traumatic memory of this, which I need you to understand, Caitlin." She wished he hadn't brought it up. She wished it didn't hurt so very much. "Understand what?" "About Marcy, which is connected to this."
"That again?
Dan, you screwed the woman."
"We were made to do what we did."
As, he thought, were you and I, my precious heart and fellow breed animal.
"Okay, I'll bite. If the devil made you do it, why? Why does he give a damn about you and Marcy, and me for that matter? He's a busy devil. He's surely got more important things on his mind."
"I cannot even begin to answer that question. I don't understand any more than you do. All I can say is, if they wanted me to get tenure, then whatever they did more than worked."
"I should say, it got you tenure and a mistress."
She heard Connor's voice rise downstairs as they reached some sort of crisis in the shrieking video game that Pauly had brought. Angrily, she shook away a tear. She didn't want to feel like this, all tragic over her marriage. She wanted to feel angry and full of righteous self-justification. She wanted to be strong enough to march off to a lawyer if that turned out to be what her heart wanted her to do. Dan reached out across the distance.
"Hey," he said.
She turned away. He sighed, got up, and went into the kitchen. As she came in behind him, he drank down a glass of wine and a couple of huge gulps. He turned, looked at her. Dear heaven, she was as beautiful as an angel. What had happened here? He was getting really scared. He was beginning to think that he'd ruined his life by being honest with her. He touched the thing in his ear, and touched, also, his memory of seeing her as a child. He looked into her eyes, saw the sorrow there. "Oh God, Caitlin, you've got to accept something. The aliens..."
"No.
Shut up. You shut up. You listen." He touched his ear again. "You know what this is. This is an implant. I got it right here in this kitchen, right here, right in front of everybody, and God only knows how they did that.
Dan, I can't handle this, I warn you."
He went to her. She turned away from him. "Caitlin, they brought us together when we were children, for God's sake." He touched her shoulder. She pulled away.
"I remember you, Caitlin, in a blue nightgown. I remember, oh my God, they've been with us all our lives."
She shook her head, waved her hand in front of her face. At that moment, Connor burst in. Can we take the DVD down?
Be my guest, Dan said. Be careful with that. The Keltons'll kill you if you mess it up.
We will,
Connor said as he raced off. Then he returned.
Plus, we need a flashlight.
A flashlight?
Check the snow, see if it's sticking.
Dan got a flashlight out of his toolkit and gave it to him.
Okay, listen, Connor said to Paulie when he returned to his basement lair. I'm reasonably sure that they've been here, in this room. Paulie's eyes opened wide.
They have?
What's interesting is I have a screen memory.
Which is, remind me.
Paulie, you've got to quit right now.
Quit what?
I can hear the laughter in your voice. You've seen the video, you know this is real, so trying to laugh me out of court is wrong. And that Connor Busters thing, Paulie, it's incredibly corny. It's the sort of thing that happens in third grade, not middle school.
It's just a joke, Connor. If you didn't take it so seriously, nobody else would either.
You gotta be more mature about these things. Kids are assholes. You get a few more years on you, you'll learn to roll with it.
Connor said, You want me to crack that game?
Jesus, yes, can you?
You know I can. But you have to promise me, Paulie, we've been friends a long time. All of our lives. You stop dumping on me.
Is that why I'm here? To get begged?
Because I'm not the one you need to beg.
You need to beg every guy in the class, Connor, because they all think you're a complete schmedlock. The schmedlock of the century.
Paulie, if you quit, they will quit, which you know very well.
You got guts, I'll say that.
You cracked the game for me and the Connor Busters are on hold for a week. You vector in the grays, and I'm your puppy dog.
He pulled a Nikon digital camera out of his backpack. 6 megapixels. Detailed pictures should be worth a fortune.
So, when do they show up?
He looked at his watch.
The exact time will be 3:33, Connor said. He realized that he was setting himself up for something. The odds against him felt huge.
Okay, then. Let's synchronize watches.
My watch.
Connor.
Everybody on Planet Bell Attached knows that your Christmas watch automatically sets itself to the Naval Observatory time signal once every 12 hours, so let me rephrase that. Let me synchronize my ordinary watch to your awesome one.
Paulie, you want this watch?
He started to take it off.
Connor, you just do not get it. I don't want your watch.
If you're going to get people off your back, you need to stop bragging and showing off. Everybody knows you're a genius. Half the school are geniuses. Maybe you're our major genius, I don't know. But kids don't like having their faces rubbed in the kind of shit you dish out.
I'm not understanding you.
Like night before last. You actually tried to communicate with the aliens you thought were out there in English and French. That was so lame, Connor.
I hadn't realized that.
Well, try Capaxian next time. I'm sure you're fluent in that, too.
Now, little boy, if you're going to crack Gestapo, crack it and I'll suck your toes.
Connor, Caitlin called.
Okay, okay, in a while.
It's after 10.
So, little boy, we going to get tucked in by Mommy?
No, we're not at your house, little boy. Come on.
Connor went across the room and out under the deck. He was outside before he asked himself why he'd done this. He just suddenly felt like coming out.
Paulie joined him.
Wow, is it ever snowing? Look at this.
He danced around, then went down on his back and made an angel. He leaped up.
It's butt cold. We need our coats.
As he ran back inside, Connor pointed the flashlight upward and flicked it on and off. As he'd learned, he varied the signal. 3 long, 3 short, 2 long, 2 short. The beam revealed a whirling maelstrom of snowflakes, dancing, racing before the wind. The air was sharp with smoke and the tang of ice. Off to the west, thunder rumbled. Connor went on signaling, even though it was nowhere near 3:33. Even though it felt hopeless. Even though Paulie was probably right, and he dreamed up the whole thing.
Lame-o, Connor. I mean, you really are trying. You believe this?
Shut up. Paulie brushed Connor's head with his hand.
Ah, little boy's getting all covered with snow, isn't he?
Connor stopped signaling. A light glowed around them just then. It didn't last long, but it came from above.
Oh, Jesus, Connor said. He started signaling again.
It was lightning.
They're here.
He looked up, letting the snow pummel his face.
You guys, he whispered. Come on down.
Suddenly, and without a word, Paulie took off toward the house. Then, in the distance, Connor heard the Kelton's dog, Manrico, set up a howl. He looked in the direction of the Kelton's place and saw, standing at the edge of the yard as if they'd just come up out of the woods, three kids. They had really big heads, and their eyes were terrible in the reflected light from the house.
Paulie,
Connor whispered. But Paulie was standing under the deck, as still as death.
Paulie.
Then he saw that they had a lantern. He looked at it glowing in the snow, the interior flickering orange.
Mom,
he called, but it came out as a whisper. He fought to form the word.
Mom?
It stayed in his throat. They came across the snowy lawn, sort of floating just above the ground, floating and flickering. Connor was terrified beyond anything he'd ever thought possible. It was freezing cold fear, a fear so deep he had not known that it could exist. Had he been insane? Why had he done this? The thought crossed his mind that this was yet another joke, but then he heard them. A buzzing sound like huge flies, a sound that was really, really strange, that was not of this world. They remained out in the gushing, swirling snow. The lantern wasn't a lantern at all. It was a very black metal thing with glowing holes in it that sort of looked like eyes, and it seemed to Connor as if it was sort of alive, too. The three aliens came closer, moving swiftly and accurately now, no longer floating and flickering. They were like wolves in the snow now, and they were clearly interested in him. And then there was something on his shoulder, as light as if a bird had landed there. Almost too scared to move, he looked down. A hand was there, with fingers like long, thin snakes, and black claws. 18. Connor had to run. He had to get out of here, but then the world distorted, seeming almost to bend, and the glowing thing was right in front of his face, and he was staring into the orange light inside where there were millions of glowing threads. They were just threads of light, but he couldn't look away from them. He had to keep staring. One of the creatures pulled his shirt front up, and he felt something pushing against his chest and getting hotter and hotter, and he couldn't stop it, and he had to because it was burning him. The snow swirled and lightning flashed, and there was a loud snap like a wire had come down and was spitting in the yard. Suddenly Connor realized that he was alone. He was standing in the snow, and he had to get back inside because somebody was out here who should not be, and he was in danger. He'd seen black eyes and orange light, terrible light, but the rest of it was all confused. Had he met the aliens? He wasn't sure. Or no, he was sure. He hadn't. He'd pointed the light at the sky and everything, but they hadn't shown up. He opened the door. He walked past Paulie, who, without a word, went into the bathroom and drank glass after glass of water. When he came out, he was transformed from a posturing preteen into the little boy he had been as recently as last summer. "I want to go home," he said quietly. Then he ran upstairs. Connor ran after him. Paulie burst into the living room. "I want to go home," he yelled. "Paulie?" Caitlin asked. Paulie looked toward Connor, his face soaked with tears. Connor went closer to him. "Hey, man?"
"Don't let him near me."
Caitlin got to her feet.
"What in the world did you do to him, Connor?"
Connor shook his head.
"Here. Come here to me, Paulie, honey. I've dealt with a lot of scared guys in my time, honey."
Caitlin took him by the hand.
"Now we are going into the kitchen, fellas. And guess what we're going to do? We are going to make a big old-fashioned pot of hot chocolate flavored with brandy. Would you like that?"
"We have brandy?" Dan asked.
I'm not allowed to drink. This is a very tiny bit, Polly, Caitlin said as she drew him toward the kitchen.
Hey, guy, Dan said to Connor.
Yes, Dad. Dan patted the couch cushion. Connor sat down beside him.
Connor, did you... No, better way to do this.
What did that to him?
Don't know.
He was okay, then he wasn't.
Did you perhaps have a fight? It was awfully noisy down there at one point.
No, no fight.
No, that wouldn't make him cry.
What made him cry, Connor?
Homesick, maybe?
No. Connor's chest hurt. He tried to sort of move his shirt away from it to not have anything touch it. Dan saw and lifted it.
What's going on here?
Nothing.
Yeah, there is. Caitlin, could you come back, please?
Connor heard a voice.
Hello, Connor.
Hi.
Dan said,
Hi what?
Be quiet.
He started to talk, but it was like somebody had grabbed his throat from the inside.
This is real, Connor.
A coldness raced in Connor's veins. This was somebody that was inside him, somebody else alive, in him.
Caitlin, something's not right here.
Don't tell them, Connor.
She came in.
Look at his chest.
Connor, what have you boys been doing?
Polly had followed her. She turned to him.
Polly, you tell me. Have you boys been playing too rough?
No, Mrs. Callahan.
Mom?
Son, you're all skinned up. You look like you've been sandpapered. So I want to know what you were doing.
Connor had no way to respond. He wasn't sure why he was hearing this voice, only that it was not being heard by anybody else.
That's right, Connor.
Mom and Polly returned to the kitchen, followed by Dan. Connor hesitated a moment, then hurried after them. He was trying not to be scared, because this was the real thing. This was contact. But he was not just somewhat scared. He was so scared that he was actually dizzy. He knew what had been done to him. They had put a communications device in his chest.
Right again.
The kitchen was filling with the smell of cocoa, and it seemed so wonderfully comfortable it almost made him burst into tears. He ran over and threw his arms around his mother's waist and tried not to let Polly hear him crying.
What is the matter with these boys? Caitlin asked.
I think it's called nervous energy running on fumes. When's your bedtime, Polly?
Whenever.
I repeat the question, Paul Warner. When is your bedtime?
9:30.
It's already 10:45, Dan said. You must be tuckered out.
Connor's an 11 o'clock guy, Caitlin said. But you're tired too, right?
I'm tired.
Polly nodded into the mug of hot chocolate that Caitlin had just poured him. They drank their cocoa in silence, and the voice did not recur. Connor began to hope that it had been an auditory hallucination, because if contact was going to mean you had a voice inside you, that was going to take a whole lot of getting used to. He'd read most of his father's abnormal psych texts, so he hoped it wasn't an early symptom of schizophrenia, the curse of the excessively intelligent, even though that might actually be better than having an alien communications device buried in his damn chest. He and Polly did not argue about going to bed upstairs. There was no way that either of them were going anywhere near that basement again tonight. In fact, Connor considered proposing to Dan that they brick the thing up tomorrow and just forget about it. After they were both in pajamas and had their teeth brushed, Polly said,
I'm sorry about not believing you.
About what? He put his arms on Connor's shoulders and pushed his lips close to his ear.
The aliens.
I saw them. I saw the whole thing.
Forget it, Polly.
Forget it? Are you nuts?
I saw aliens in your yard, man. 3 of them.
We don't know what we saw.
Hello?
You were the big believer. You were the guy who was vectoring them in.
Maybe I made a mistake.
Maybe you didn't.
They left it there, and soon Polly was asleep.
Connor watched the night, listened to the snow whispering on the window panes, and wondered how the world really worked.
There came that voice again, very quick, trembling with something like fear and something that, oddly enough, sounded to Connor like a sort of awe. Soon you will know.
19. Charles Gunn pulled up to the presidential safe house on Embassy Row. The mansion had been acquired during World War II, when the Roosevelt administration was concerned that Hitler might develop a long-range bomber and attack the White House. Successive administrations had continued to use it, and during the Cold War, tunnel access had been added across the mile that separates it from the White House. Now it functioned as a very private presidential enclave, at present ostensibly owned by Washington insider Larry Prince, but actually under the control of the Secret Service. He walked quickly to the door, which was opened as he approached. A young man in a dark suit, with an earbud in his ear and the bulge of a small machine gun under his jacket, stepped aside and let him through the metal detector. Another young man fell in ahead of them, and the three of them proceeded silently down the hall, then turned right into the president's ornate office. The president didn't know it yet, but he was going to provide a diversion that would, hopefully, deceive the Greys into looking in the wrong direction for the source of danger to their evil little child. It might well mean that the president would himself be killed, but to Charles, this was of little consequence. He was watching the news and paging through a speech.
"Hey there, Chester," he said without looking up. "Just give me a second here."
Then a moment later, "Pull up a chair."
"It's Charles, sir," Charles said as he sat down.
On the wall of this office there were paintings chosen by FDR, the most spectacular being a Nicolas Poussin landscape with St. John on Patmos. As Charles knew, and as FDR had certainly known, the geometry of the painting resolved into a date, 2012. That this was the year of tribulation had been known by the secret societies that had created Western civilization literally from the very beginning. The date had been handed down through the Masonic community, from the ancient Egyptian priesthood, who had divined it by looking through the last clear glass of man's old, lost science, a window into the future. This had been at Abydos in Egypt, and some of the other things they had seen had been commemorated on beams that held up the temple's roof to this day.
"So," the president finally said, "how are you going to make me miserable today, Charles?"
"Mr. President,
you never come here with good news. All your good news is secret. So hit me."
"The Greys are acting against us in a major and very bizarre way."
"The Greys are acting bizarre? You're kidding. I sit here astonished."
Charles had constructed his lie carefully.
"Sir, they're going to do something that will reveal to the public the fact that the government's been concealing their presence for 60 years. They're going to destroy our credibility."
The president pointed a finger at his own temple.
"Exactly. They're trying to undermine the government. First, the public becomes aware that they're real. Second, people tell about their abductions. Third, it's discovered that we're helpless. Chaos follows."